And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie McLaughlin here. We're on Solidarity Breakfast at 3CR, and today we're celebrating International Day of Disabled People. We're going to, this is the International Day of People with Disabilities, and we're going to celebrate it all day on 3CR because it's such an important day. And we're going to look at some of the issues, politics, that have been brought to the fore by people with disabilities as they become more and more vocal about their rights as citizens. So today we're going to start off with a little bit of a look, a small perusal of some of the milestones, political milestones for people with disabilities. And we're going to move on with a look at sport and recreation, which is an important part of anybody's life, but particularly for people with disabilities. It helps in a whole range of ways to increase life's joys as well as longevity. So we're going to talk to the CEO of Disability Sports and Recreation. And you might have been aware that on December the 1st, they had their annual Sports and Recreation Day down by the Yarra. The great fun was had by all. And it's very illuminating to discover what people can do in the physical world when they've got a variety of disabilities. Because, of course, everything gets set up for people, the mythical 30-year-old male who is fit and trim. Anyway, that's coming up later on, and you will be relieved to know that Kevin Healy, This Is The Week That Was, will be played at 8:20, even on a special day like this. And the last half hour we're going to devote to looking at wage justice, because it's a long-term thing when it comes to people with disabilities. You're on 3CR, Solidarity Breakfast with Annie.
I'm not disabled. I'm only disabled by society's inability to provide me with the supports and services I need.
Celebrate International Day of People with Disability all day, Saturday 3rd of December, with 3CR.
There's got to be inclusive thinking, there's got to be inclusive action, and there's got to be inclusive practising.
Why the hell aren't we a bigger voting bloc?
You're on 3CR, Solidarity Breakfast, celebrating International Day of People with Disabilities. And as I said, we are going to have a look at a few of the milestones in the political struggle for people with disabilities. The mantra, "Nothing about us, without us," is a slogan embraced by people with disability, and in fact is represented in part by the very fact that there is a UN-designated day, December the 3rd, today, as International Day of People with Disability. This happened in 1992, the same year the Disability Discrimination Act was passed. But people with disability and their supporters have been fighting a long, hard battle to get their basic rights as citizens. They're still fighting. Let's go back and check some of the milestones in this fight in Australia. For people with disability in the 1970s, a medical model of disability prevailed. The majority of people with disability were denied their basic rights, with institutionalisation still standard. Let's hear some voices of those who experienced this.
My mother put me into queue when I was a boy, when I went from place to place. Still, they took me to Kula. They said, "You are only here for a holiday." What was not true. I was in a locked ward. I was in an institution for about 30 years. I got no training. I learned to read and write after I left. We did not get good health care. If you said you had a headache, the staff would just tell you to drink plenty of cold water. It was not safe. One time there was a fight in this with this guy, got his arm broken. He did not get a doctor for a long time because all the staff were in upper rooms talking. I wasn't bashed, but other people I know were. I was not taken into the shed on the farm. Other people I know were. Everybody were too scared to tell on them. It was cold at night with only one blanket and pillow. The mattress was well thin. If you did not get up in the morning, they throw a bucket of water on you. The food come from the kitchen in the grounds, and it was cold. The tea taste, if it had salt in it, bitter and cold. If you come in late for breakfast or lunch or dinner, they'll throw you out. You did not get anything to eat. Some staff were okay, some staff were very bad. One staff member used to run football games, but when he moved into administration, it all stopped. Other times staff made up lies about me. When I got up, they said, no breakfast for you, and I was taken to Mont Park Hospital. The doctor said, the staff said, you had talking about killing yourself. And I said, no, but I never did. But they didn't believe me. And I had shock treatment for five years. They wanted to keep me at Mom Park, and I was a good worker in cleaning up the ward. I did not know why the staff made up stories about me. Maybe they did not have anything to do. I ran away, but the staff saw me on the highway and the police picked me up and brought me back. For punishment, they stripped me off in the...
Robert and Marlene Brewer were also residents at Kalula Training Centre, and I asked them about their memories of Sunbury.
Well, I used to be in Sunbury and they used to treat us like nothing on earth. They used to treat us really rough, really bad. And if you go out, don't come back, they'll come after you and bring you back. And look here, it's a bad place to live in for anybody.
So how long did you live there, Robert?
I was there for about 24 years.
It's a long time.
It is a long time. No, the food was no good. Terrible. Very bad stuff. Couldn't eat it. And they used to put us on low-actual tablets and low-actual syrup. And real bad stuff.
Did you live in Sunbury too, Marlene?
Yeah, I went there when I was 18. They do rotten things up there. They lock you in the single room, four of us, and someone come around, and she got into trouble giving them bread and water, no food.
That's disgusting.
It is disgusting. How long were you there, Marlene?
Too long.
So, did you meet Sunbury?
Yeah,
I was sorry to get married when I was older.
So, what's your life like now that you're not in somewhere like Sunbury?
My life much better. I got myself out up there, Sunbury. So, Robert's the best man.
That sounds good. What makes you the best man, Robert?
Because I look after her. And also go out to work. Selling the big issue in the city. Yeah, down near Flagstaff Station. And keeps me busy. when I get home, I feel like I'm having my lunch and lay down and have a sleep. And,
...1975 marks the UN Declaration on the Rights of Persons with Disability. By 1979, the policy of deinstitutionalisation came to the fore, but issues around access to basic services such as transport and medical treatment for people with disabilities were in marked contrast to the general population. Something as simple as a right to use public transport had to be fought for, and by the 1980s we find the next step in the empowerment of disabled people, public protest and self-advocacy. The first demonstration of disabled people and their supporters at a Sydney train station was received by shocked establishment. Julie Phillips, a disability advocate.
This was about the opening of an Eastern Suburbs Railway in 1979. It's Australia. This protest was directed at the lack of wheelchair accessibility to public transport in Australia. Gee, lucky things have changed so much, isn't it? Ha, ha, ha. And a group of about 15 people in wheelchairs and about 10 people without disabilities participated in this rally. It's obviously New South Wales. Premier Neville Wran admitted in 1981. The International Year of Disabled People was the first to introduce a wheelchair-accessible taxi service into Australia. And haven't we come a long way there as well? Where's Frank? There. No. That he was inspired to do because of this protest. Although not every single bus, train and station is accessible, the Disability Discrimination Act stipulates that total accessibility of all public transport is to be achieved within the decade. I just left that there for a joke, really.
...1981 saw the founding of Reinforce, a self-advocacy organisation run for and by people with an intellectual disability, while Women with Disabilities Feminist Collective loudly protested the Miss Australia Beauty Quest. This was an initiative by disability activist Leslie Hall, and this also shocked the Australian public.
Miss Australia Quest was a beauty pageant that ran from 1954 until 2000. Hands up if you're old enough to know. Yep, good on you to know that. Miss Australia. Whereby Miss Australia would raise money for the Spastic Centre of Australia, another lovely PC name, through their family and friends. However, some people with disabilities started protesting against the pageant due to its focus on stereotyped images of physical perfection and the ethics of a charity fundraising in that manner. Protesters felt that they were belittled by the beauty quest, and that the Spastic Society, which organised the contest, was exploiting their disabilities in order to raise money. The protests received significant press coverage and provoked a range of responses, including strong support from people within the Spastic Society and other disability charities, and also criticism from people with disabilities. Despite the objections, the protests marked a symbolic shift in the mode of public thinking about the place of people with disabilities in Australian society.
Now we've got... There's been plenty of protests against, you know, beauty contests and stuff from feminist kind of perspectives, you know, but very rarely is ever a protest against a beauty statement because of a disability issue. You know, the fact that sort of that these people are kind of perfect human beings, you know, the perfect model walking across, you know, no limp, no nothing.
And is that why you think she's used SS?
Yeah.
As in, like, a Nazi?
Yeah. And so this is the kind of thing that happens with that, you know, you don't mind if we're sexist because what we're trying to do is raise money for the disabled. No one could conceive that anyone would be able to protest. So that was the amazing nexus that she broke through. She was able to say, no, that is not enough. That is not good enough, you know. And she broke that nexus. And once she broke that, the import of what she'd done had literally started the dynamite, I think, you know.
By 1986 to 7, the Self-Advocacy Resource Unit was set up to resource self-advocacy groups across Victoria. Its motto was, "We are stronger when we work together." The groundbreaking 3CR Raising Our Voices starts giving a voice to people with intellectual disabilities.
You are now listening to Raising Our Voices, 8:55 and on your radio dial.
This show is produced by Amida and Rainforce.
Looking at accommodations, rights for people with intellectual disabilities, with focus on housing issues.
I'm not disabled. I'm only disabled by society's inability to provide me with the supports and services I need.
Celebrate International Day of People with Disability all day, Saturday, 3rd of December, with 3CR.
There's got to be inclusive thinking. There's got to be inclusive action. And they've got to be inclusive practising.
Why the hell aren't we a bigger voting bloc?
During the 1990s, with increasing pressure from people with disabilities and their supporters, we see the federal government passed the Disability Discrimination Act, while in 2006, the UN adopted the International Convention on Rights of People with Disabilities, which Australia ratifies in 2008. Matthew Bowden, a former CEO of the Australian Federation of Disability Organisations, gives an insight into the importance of this declaration as he talks about the rights of people with disability to intimacy.
So Anne Craft was writing about that in the 1980s, and of course now we have the United Nations Convention, or CRPD as I'll refer to it. Basically, it was fantastic that CRPD spoke directly at the sexual rights of people with disability, the right to sort of marry and form a family, the right to receive family planning, reproductive assistance, sexuality education, to exercise rights. One thing that I was really delighted to see in the convention was around retaining fertility for both women and for children, particularly girls with disability, where, you know, it really spoke at the issue of sterilisation. States have a responsibility to enable people with disability to parent and assist them in areas where they might need assistance. And it also spoke about including and keeping children with disabilities in families. It also spoke at the overrepresentation of children of parents who have disability in care and protection systems. It sort of basically says that intervention should never be based on the parent having disability, but only should be occur in the case of the best interests of the child, where there clearly is abuse or neglect occurring. And in the instances where family placement not being possible, that alternative placements must occur in family settings, which obviously speaks at children not being placed in children's homes or institutions when a family placement breaks down. So it was great that we got that. Sterilisation still occurs in Australia of particularly mostly women and girls with disability. There are excessive and extreme controls of the sexualities of women, and there seems to be an enormous fear. And I think that this also sort of ties in with the notions of eugenics, of women's capacity to have children and that those children might also have disability. And this is something that society seems to be really frightened of. Obviously, there are enormous negative sort of psychological and physiological impacts of a woman having sterilisation without her consent or knowledge or being coerced into it. We also do work in the area of the sort of over-prescription or the readiness of doctors to prescribe anti-androgenic medication. These are medications to control the libidos of men where there's sort of unwanted sexual behaviour. However, we're often seeing this not being prescribed for men who are sex offenders as a part of a sort of treatment program, but often men with intellectual disability who are masturbating more than somebody thinks that they should, or masturbating in a place where somebody thinks that they shouldn't be doing it. We're seeing anti-androgenic medication being prescribed in boys as young as, you know, 12 and 13 years old, where no other attempts have been made to educate those boys about where might be an appropriate place to masturbate, or any sort of education programs. It's straight to the drugs cabinet and, you know, slamming them down. And, I mean, I view this as a sort of form of chemical castration. We most commonly have seen this being used in men who are Aboriginal or men who are from other culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and I don't think that that is a coincident or accident at all. The sterilisation of women has an enormous impact on them, of course. It also has an impact on people in their community. It has an impact on their partners. I've worked with men with intellectual disability who've spoken to me about their sort of sadness at not being able to be a father because of what was done to their partner and the impact that it's had on them and their relationship. So it's not just an isolated thing that only the woman who has the operation experiences. We do quite a bit of work around people with intellectual disability who are living with HIV/AIDS. Again, we see an appalling response from disability support services, health providers, and people in the community, where there's enormous amounts of stigma and discrimination towards those individuals, and a great attempt to control them. These are people that we see being contained, and often without any sort of approval from guardianship, where people are kept away for the benefit of, you know, supposedly for the benefit of the community. We've most often seen this occur for women who are living with HIV, for Aboriginal people, and again, people from culturally, linguistically diverse background. Again, I don't think it's an accident who we're deciding to keep away from our communities and that we think are dangerous or that we should be afraid of. People obviously have the right to information. Information means that people will be safe. This is one of the things that we advocate for. Access to sexual and reproductive health services is something else that we see as critical.
Let's hear from disability advocate Rhonda Galbally give some insight into how things stand for people with disabilities in Australia by 2009 as she talks at the Press Council about Shut Out, the Experience with Disabilities and Their Families in Australia report.
What does it mean to be an Australian with a disability in 2009? What is life like in the lucky country, in this land of the fair go, if you're a son or daughter of this sunburnt country? One answer we might expect would be a citizen with the same rights as everyone else. But if you have a physical, sensory, psychiatric or intellectual disability, what is life really like? Many Australians would say, it's better, isn't it? The bad old days are gone, aren't they? The horror and abuse that went on in institutions, that's all gone now, hasn't it? The poverty, the discrimination, the exclusion, the fear and hatred, that's all ancient history, isn't it? Women and men of the National Press Club, I would love to be able to say, yes, that is all ancient history, but I can't. I'm here to tell you that despite this nation enjoying the longest economic boom in its history, very little has changed for most Australians with a disability. They are still discriminated against. They are still abused. They are still isolated. They are still living in poverty. And they are still treated with fear and loathing in their own country. And if you don't believe me, let me tell you a story. A young man with Down syndrome goes to a cafe with a group of his friends. The cafe's in a public park. the young man becomes separated from his group. Lost, he walks around the park looking for his friends and he comes to a playground. And there are some families in the playground. And as this young man has younger siblings, he tries to talk to the children. But one of the dads screams at him to get away from the kids. And now the young man is scared and he tries to ask some of the adults at the playground for help. So what do these parents do to help this young man with an intellectual disability who is lost, alone, and scared? They all scream at him too, and no one helps him. He is shunned. He is driven away. They want nothing to do with him. Because he is disabled, they assume he is a threat, and they want him out of their park. Women and men, this is a true story, and it's not ancient history. It happened a few weeks ago in a suburban park in Melbourne. And that's my city, where I come from. Melbourne, a city that's supposed to be one of the most livable cities in the world. But livable for whom? Not that young man. One study found that people with a psychiatric or intellectual disability will have a negative social experience within 15 minutes of leaving their home. Australia is not a livable country for people with a disability. And I could tell you so many stories, like the ones about children who are not welcome at childcare centres and kindergartens because they have a disability, like the ones about children expelled from school because they have a disability, or the one about the young man who lost his promotion because he was unable to organise new support services in another state within 6 months of winning a new job. Or the ones about the young people living in group homes, forced to go to bed every night at 5 p.m. because the staff say so, unable to help themselves to food from the locked fridges, unable to go out for a walk through the locked doors. Or the one about a young man who was assaulted by a fellow resident in his group home, but who continued to live under the same roof as his abuser because there was nowhere for either of them to go. Or the ones about the people who'll sleep in their wheelchairs tonight because there's no one around to help to get them to bed. Or the ones about the families who become so desperate they abandon their children in respite care or in hospital because they can no longer care for them at home. There are so many stories to tell, and each with its own heartbreaking punchline. And you will find them in this report shut out.
2010 saw Kelly Vincent elected to South Australian Parliament for Dignity for Disability Party, as the voices of the people with disability make themselves heard within the structures that formerly actively oppressed them.
And I think it's important to acknowledge that a really active disability movement in Australia is really quite a new thing, you know, and we're very slowly moving away from this idea that disability exists in a charity model. People give poor little Jimmy his new wheelchair or whatever else it is that he needs. But I think we're slowly moving away from that toward a social justice model that says, well, really, Jimmy is symbolic of everyone in this state that needs these services, and we shouldn't give them out of charity, we're out of justice and out of saying that this is a basic right and this is what this many people need to live dignified and fulfilling lives. So I really think that that's quite a young movement in itself, so it will take some time to really get the momentum that it needs.
In 2016, on one hand, the National Disability Insurance Scheme is being rolled out. This scheme is based on the idea that the disabled person themselves will have control of their service delivery. In this brave new world, people with disability still fight for wages justice, which we discuss later in the show, and places like Vision Australia no longer see it as a core function to provide employment for their clients. We will give the last word in our small look at disability politics to a representative of the Blind Workers Union at the time of the sacking of the blind workers.
Affected are our communities most disadvantaged?
Whereas, for example, if you have no vision impairment, and I'm not for 1 minute suggesting it's easy, but you may, for example, be employed as a builder, a road digger, a taxi driver, you know, all those sort of things, stacking shelves on supermarkets, whatever, cleaner. When you're blind or vision impaired, your only opportunity in manual labour was pretty well the two facilities which they've closed. So it's a manual labour sector, using your hands, whereas the people that Vision Australia employ and the rest of the organisation are in the area of technology and so forth. So they've got a different skill set.
Organisations of this sort are the workforce.
I'm not disabled. I'm only disabled by society's inability to provide me with the supports and services I need.
Celebrate International Day of People with Disability all day, Saturday, 3rd of December, with 3CR.
There's got to be inclusive thinking. There's got to be inclusive action, and there's got to be inclusive practising.
Why the hell aren't we a bigger voting bloc?
You're on Solidarity Breakfast with me, Annie. We're celebrating International Day of People with Disabilities. And as I said already, on December the 1st, Disability Sports and Recreation held its annual Sports and Recreation Fair down by the Yarra. And it was highlighting the health benefits of sports and recreation for people with disability. Unsurprisingly, these can be life-changing activities, as they are for everyone. Anyway, I went down to the offices of Disability Sports and Recreation and spoke to CEO Richard Amon to find out more.
Well, our broad function is to improve the health of people with disability through participation in sport and recreation. We've been around for over 50 years, an organisation that grew out of two pioneers who went to the 1960 Paralympics and competed in wheelchair sports. And then they formed a body that eventually became the Paravic Sports Club and then eventually became Wheelchair Sports Victoria. And then about 6 years ago, our board decided to change its focus to be a much broader organisation that covered a range of disabilities and tried to support a range of sports, but change the focus as well to include recreation and really to try and promote the health benefits of people participating in sport and recreation. We work to try and improve an environment where it's easier for people with a disability to be active. So originally we used to run, for example, the sport of wheelchair basketball, but now we've what's termed mainstream that to Basketball Victoria. So ultimately it's probably the best outcome that the sports are integrated within their mainstream sporting bodies. So we've done that with wheelchair basketball. We did a similar thing with intellectual disability with a soccer team. And with Lawn Bowls, we used to run programs. They're now run by Bowls Victoria. So where we can, we've mainstreamed our sporting activities, but we are currently the state body for wheelchair rugby because it doesn't really align itself closely with the sport of mainstream rugby. So That's one aspect about sport delivery, but we still run some activities for people with disability to be involved with, such as summer and winter camps, and we provide a range of opportunities for them to get active using our equipment library. We have a library where they can come and borrow some adaptive equipment to get them started in a sport which they might not have been able to participate in.
So do you have to invest time and thought into adapting particular sports?
I would love to. If we had unlimited resources, we would love to do that. Essentially, we're a charity, so we rely on mostly community donations to allow us to exist. So we have to spend our resources best where we best can. But we often have people coming to us with ideas and suggestions about how a sport or how an activity can be adapted, and we'll work with them as much as we can to try and help them along their journey of making their activity more accessible. As an example, this week I had a guy come to visit me who's working with a new water ski cable park that's being developed in the southeast of Melbourne, and he's trying to make it as inclusive as possible, and he's working on a whole range of technical, I guess, outcomes that's going to deliver a para-wakeboarding sort of opportunity for people with a disability. So we said to him that we can help him with promoting it, with promoting it to our members, with potentially some activities about training their staff so they can be more accessible in their dealings with people with disability. So we can work with them to try and make it a better environment for that activity to have more chance of being successful.
So if there are leagues or groups of people that are involved in trying to mainstream sports that want to increase their availability to people who have got disabilities, you're the people that can help them.
We can help. I mean, we work with in two ways. We work a lot with what we call the Victorian Disability Sport and Recreation Organisations Committee, which is a bit of a mouthful, but that's a committee of about 13 different organisations such as Blind Sports Victoria and Deaf Sports Victoria and Special Olympics. So we work with them to try and improve their capacity. So we like to see ourselves as a peak body for those organisations. So we have some funding from the state government to try and support those organisations to be more, I guess, efficient and more productive in the way that they work, to try and make it a better environment in general for people with disability. They're the specialist disability sporting groups, but then we have the other side of the coin, which is our mainstream organisations, such as Basketball Victoria and Tennis Victoria and the like, and they have their own inclusive practices and programs, and where possible, we work with them to try and help make sure that they're more effective and that they can work better to serve the people that they're hoping to serve.
So is there a clue in there that there's an element of inclusion going on? So there's a sort of a marrying of the mainstream and the disabled communities so that the disabled communities are considered mainstream?
Well, I mean, ultimately, the ultimate game is that sport is sport for all. And that means that everybody should be able to participate. And the broader inclusion, I guess, drive that's happening in a lot of sectors now, it includes people with disability, but it also includes gender, includes race, includes, you know, sexual orientation and those sorts of things. So the word inclusion can mean a lot of different things. And so the current way of thinking and the promotion, I guess, from government and other areas is that sport should be something that's available to everybody. And so where, I guess, my organisation is really looking at purely the disability component about trying to make it easier for someone to become more active and to get involved.
And you have a big recreation sports day, don't you?
Yeah. Well, every year we do a broad festival around International Day with people. International Day of People with Disability. We used to have it at Federation Square for the last 6 years, but this year we're hosting it at Cran Riverwalk, which is a much more of a flat, accessible venue. And this year, because of the better venue, we've got 47 exhibitors who are now coming on the day to provide an exhibition about what sports are available, what equipment is available, so that someone with a disability can come along and really find out about a whole world of sport and recreation that they wouldn't previously have been aware of.
What are the 48? Give us some examples of the 47 exhibitors. Can you, off the top of your head?
There's a whole range. I mean, they might be sports such as Hockey Victoria or Cycling Victoria or Netball Victoria, but there's other organisations such as Scope who work with communication with people with disability. There's YMCA who are demonstrating what camps they have available. There's specialist equipment suppliers who, for example, might provide recumbent bicycles and hand cycles that allows people with disability to be active in a cycling sense. So there's a whole range of people from specialist disability organisations to state sporting organisations to support organisations, or also just a whole range of people who are providing equipment that helps people to become more active. So in the we're providing this festival, and we do it every year, and we fund it with some support from sponsors, but we mainly fund it from community donations. And we do it because it's a one-stop opportunity for people to come and really find out what's available, because we know that that's one of the biggest barriers to people starting a life of participation.
Now, you're doing it in a very public arena, so therefore it is also to promote the disabled community to everybody else.
Exactly. I mean, that's a great point. What we found is that by having it at Federation Square, that it used to get a huge traffic from people who were just walking past, and all of a sudden they can see activities that's going on. We have three different activity zones where we're able to demonstrate a whole range of different activities on the day, and we have a wheelchair basketball tournament that happens on the day. And so what we find is that so many people just walk past and become exposed to this, and they walk away with a much greater understanding and awareness about what people with disability can actually do. And that's really, again, one of the other key barriers to participation is the community attitudes and awareness. So we can really achieve a huge amount on that day by having everything in a really prominent location and being able to really demonstrate what's possible.
It's a very interesting thing, because iconically speaking, sport is related to Olympics, perfect body, all those kind of images of Australian bronze surfers, that type of thing. It's really important, isn't it, to connect activity, sport, recreation with people who are disabled.
Well, it is. I mean, you mentioned it's an iconic Australian thing to do, and that comes back to the core essence about what we're about. Because if it's something that is open and available to the everyday Australian, there's no reason why it shouldn't be open and equally available to someone with a disability. And also because people in Australia, we align with our sporting heroes, and we really connect with them. And so I think for someone with a disability, they really should have their own opportunities to participate. And not everyone needs to be aiming for a lead. I mean, our main goal is really to get someone to do anything. I mean, as an example, we have a group that we support, which is the Victorian Electric Wheelchair Sports Association. And what they actually do is they have very limited movement capabilities, but they can move their electric wheelchairs with a toggle switch, and they play a game on a basketball court. They bump the ball with their wheelchairs as they move them around, but they get to experience all the social and the connection benefits that sport can provide by being able to play their game on using their equipment. And they still get huge benefit. They can travel to national competitions and all those sorts of things. So they get to benefit the benefits of sport that everybody else can. And that's a really great example about how we're trying to create an environment where sport's available for everybody.
Do you register success in some way? Obviously you get some funding from government, so you have to register success in some way, but also as a charitable organisation, and obviously with a board, you need people to understand how successful you are. How do you do that?
Oh, we do it in a number of ways. I mean, we look at, with our government funding, we have to, it's mainly related to wheelchair rugby, so we track the numbers of participants in that sport. But also for our own interests, we're always very interested in what difference that we make with our community and our members. We have about 2,700 members, and about 1,600 of those are individuals with a disability. And we do a survey, an annual survey every year. We ask them how active they are and what they've been doing. And we can then compare that with the general participation statistics that we know are out there for people with disability. And from that, we're able to know that our members are generally about twice as active as what the general population is. So what that tells us is that people who get involved, who find out information and can really take advantage of the services that we provide, that we know that they're going to get more active. And we also during our festival last year, we ran some surveys of the people who were attending just to see what the outcomes of the festival was. And of the 100 people who we surveyed, we found that I think 48% of them found a new activity for them to do that they were then going to take up beyond that festival. So it really demonstrates that it's achieving some outcomes that are really important.
Have you got any anecdotes that confirm to you that doing sport, recreation is good for someone?
I've got a few. I've been in this role for 12 months, and what I've really tried to do is to really delve down deep and to get involved with some of our activities. And I've been involved with our wheelchair AFL team. I put my hand up and hopped in a wheelchair for 6 weeks and trained with the team and actually played with the team, and I got to know a few of the players and some of their experiences and some of their backgrounds. And during that participation, one of the members actually came to me and he said, "Look, Richard, I'd probably be dead if it wasn't for you guys." And it was like, oh, my God, you know, that just took my breath away to realise that what we're actually doing is actually life-changing benefits. And in another example, I was a volunteer on our winter camp where we go up to Falls Creek and we take a bunch of children to Falls Creek and we give them an on-the-snow experience. And there were a number of participants on that camp who I was able to observe dramatic changes in the way that they were able to operate in their confidence, in their ability to relate to others. And you can just see how sport and activity provides a huge amount of benefits that people can take over into the rest of their life. So it's not just the actual on-the-day sporting and recreation activity. It's their whole broader confidence and their whole connection with the wider community that really provides huge benefits.
Thanks.
One thing that we are doing that's really important, we wanted to get kids with disability more active because that's the starting point of a whole life of activity which is absolutely vital to their ongoing health. So we've developed an online game that's going to allow kids to track their activity levels and also have a gaming environment to be able to get motivated to keep going to the next level and the next challenge. And we've been very fortunate to have Dylan Alcott, which is a triple Paralympic gold medalist, as the ambassador for that program. So he actually appears in the game and he pops up at various stages and encourages the kids to go to the next level. But we're launching that on December the 1st at Glenira Sport and Aquatic Centre. The game will become live and will be active for the first time. And so we're really excited about this new initiative that hopefully is going to get a whole range of more kids being involved in sport.
So how do people access that game?
It's going to be available. We tossed up whether to make it as an app where people could download it, but the easiest way that we found is to have it available on our website. So that's going to be on www.dsr.org.au. And so from the website, you'll be able to go to the links to the game, and it's called Passport to Participation. No, Passport to Play. So it's about play, and it's called Passport to Play because it involves a passport that takes a person on a journey all around the world as they become more active. And it's a game that's aimed at kids, so they're fighting these sloths who are taking over the world and making people lazy and inactive. So by being active, they fight the sloths and they get to go on this game that takes them all around the world, discovering various different places where Dylan Alcott is there supporting them along the way.
Calling all supporters of refugee rights. Join the Refugee Action Collective for the Human Rights Day fundraiser on the 10th of December at the Reverence Hotel Footscray. Come and enjoy some of Melbourne's best music, comedy and performance poetry. Your support helps with costs of future RAC campaigns for refugee rights. Check out the Reverence Hotel's website for details. Tickets are $15 or $10 concession. Refugee Action Collective is a 3CR supporter.
If you want life, you want love, you want hope, you've got to fight for it. You want freedom, you want justice, you want peace, you've got to fight for it.
Disability culture. What is it about? You can live life free, you can live life proud, you can be living out loud.
Celebrate International Day of People with Disability all day, Saturday, 3rd of December, with 3CR. from 2 to 7pm, access all areas with live performances and progressive beats from artists and performers with a disability.
Disability cool. Disability hot. The red hot power of different with a capital D. Flatly.
A weak solidarity Breggie team listener, when today this long-haired commie greenie wouldn't work at an iron station, is emphasising the cause of people with disabilities, as if people with disabilities need their cause emphasised. Why, they've never had it so good. I can recall back in 1970 when, okay, there may have been a few barriers, a few biases, but back then governments acted. Why, they promised that all public transport, for instance, would be 100% accessible within 15 years. Are they never satisfied? Never satisfied, but should be. Those long-haired commie lots who fear US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo elect Donald Trample the poor, might trample the poor, can relax. Turns out Donald's one of them. A dangerous long-haired, well, bits of it, bits of long-haired commie greenie, confirmed by no less reliable a source than that repository of wisdom and truth, the Lord Rupert of Wapping's usual suspect columnist, Bolt Through the Head. In his predictable eulogy of Cuban revolutionary Fidel, about whom he didn't have a lot of nice things to say, in fact, none. If ever there was proof the ABC was a publicly funded waste of public funds, a long-haired commie front brainwashing the innocent, it was its coverage of Fidel's demise, he told us. And don't forget, this is out of character, because it's not often he gets stuck into the ABC. Why, it even said some good things about him, suggesting he had done good things for Cuba, ignoring the fact that the pre-revolutionary rich and their descendants were celebrating the death across the briny in Miami. So, given the ABC coverage we heard and saw, listener, led with Donald declaring Fidel was a brutal commie dictator who made Cuba unlivable, made worse, my emphasis, by prolonging their lives through its health system when they all want to die, obviously, to escape the misery, but are brutally, dictatorially kept alive by the health system, and brutally educated and housed, and the list goes on. So obviously, the Lord Rupert usual suspect columnist knows, quoting Donald, proves a long-haired commie greenie wouldn't work in an iron bias. So axiomatically, Donald must be a long-haired commie. And given the usual suspect columnist himself just a few days earlier had quoted Donald quite favourably and attacked those who attacked Donald as long-haired commies, he must have had a sudden conversion, or, and it's possible, I suppose, Bolt Through the Head himself is a closet long-haired commie greenie. The response made it obvious the pre-1959 Cuba the streets of Miami longed for and mourned was not an evil, evil, brutal dictatorship, but a good, good, greatest little economic order of them all dictatorship. Leaving us to fear for the US of people, now they have innocently elected a long-haired commie greenie to run the place, a non-brutal non-dictator. Also leaving us to ponder why, back in evil Cuba, the non-rich who did not flee across the ocean to the sanctuary of those who ran the pre-1959 economy were mourning the loss of Fidel and saying positive things about him. Something else about people with disabilities who've never had it so good. Why, I can recall back in 1980 when, okay, there may have been a few barriers, a few biases, irresponsible protesters chained themselves to trams, blocked access to railway stations, blockaded the transport minister's office claiming he didn't care about them, but back then, governments acted. Why? They promised that all public transport, for instance, would be 100% accessible within 15 years. Are they never satisfied? Don't know about you, but I've developed this minor disability myself, this spontaneous tick, uncontrollable reaction, whenever I hear the usual suspect cross benches on issues like the Smash the Evil Union's Jackboots Commission say they haven't yet decided which way they'll vote. An uncontrollable, cynical sneer. Why would that be? Canberra was the victim of irresponsible protests, which Lord Rupert of Wapping summed up with his renowned responsibility in his Wapping Sin. House of louts! A mob of 40 unruly protesters shut down Parliament after sidetracking security, many super-gluing their hands to rails. Sidetracking, which presumably means outsmarting, having a plan, a Canberra first. And that uncontrollable socialist deputy supremo Tanya Blubber-Sick blubbered that these people had attacked the very basis of our democracy. They must realise the government will not close down the concentration camps, refugee idyllic holiday island resorts, and should put their faith in democracy, trust in our role as an opposition, guaranteeing we will not close down the refugee idyllic holiday island resorts. And Lord Rupert and his government and his opposition agreed people have a right to protest, but they must protest responsibly. And by responsible, Lord Rupert spoke for them, my government and my opposition and we mean it must have no impact whatever. Must be ineffectual, Lord Rupert. Same thing, you idiot. Meanwhile, the government has declared it will not be held to ransom. The passage of the Crush the Evil Union's Jackboots Commission Bill shows we won't be held to ransom, big Supremo Malcolm Turnbull declared. So the bill is identical to the one you called an urgent election over and forgot to mention during the months and months of campaigning? Certainly identical. Well, apart from a few minor changes, minor amendments suggested by our very, very, very close friends on the crossbenches. To make it less draconian on workers, allow unions to act like unions. Oh, no, that's totally unchanged. The government and our very, very, very close friends agreed that evil must not be changed. No, we've eliminated any clauses that may have innocently captured caring employers and contractors. We've provided more work for caring employers. Sensible amendments ensuring the bill crushes only those who must be crushed. And, hang 'em high, Senator Derrid Lynchum puffed out his chest, I made sure on this December 3, evil unions usurping our symbol of freedom, the Eureka flag, will remain a capital offence. What about their freedom? I exercised my freedom and they are now free not to fly it. But they did display their human side through that side-splitting stand-up comedian serving caring business class finances minister Kelly Oda, why are workers so evil, who told a superannuation audience union super funds must be forced to adopt the same standards as banks and financial institutions. She had the audience rolling in the aisles. Very funny person. Falsely claiming being crushed, people with disabilities have never had it so good. Why, I can recall back in 1990, when, okay, there may have been a few barriers, a few biases, irresponsible protesters chained themselves to trams, blocked access to railway stations, blockaded the Transport Minister's office, claiming he didn't care about them. Remember the late Katie Ball irresponsibly blocking access or locking on and then having the gall, the cruelty, to slam on the brakes when the constabulary tried to move her wheelchair, which weighed about 15 tonnes, give or take, resulting in all these coppers staggering around Melbourne with hernias and serious back injuries. All over minor issues like closing railway lines, St Kilda and Port Melbourne, which removed wheelchair access, but back then governments acted. Why, they promised that all public transport, for instance, would be 100% accessible within 15 years. Are they never satisfied? On Malcolm's strongman declaration he won't be held to ransom, this backpacker tax business proves his point. Our position is 32% and we won't budge. Big economic guru scuttled them more last son was adamant. Yes, our position is 19% and we won't budge. He was firm. Absolutely. It's 15% or nothing. Well, or 32. Scuttled them was unswerving. We won't be held to ransom. Back to those false claims by people with disabilities who've never had it so good. Why, I can recall back in 2000 when, okay, there may have been a few barriers, a few biases, irresponsible protesters carrying on, but back then governments acted. Why, they promised that all public transport, for instance, would be 100% accessible within 15 years. Are they never satisfied? Indeed, with so many claiming a pension from the public purse on the specious grounds they have trouble finding work or even claim they can't work, and all this money being poured into the NDIS, the insurance scheme, don't they have any conscience at all? Don't they know True Blue Aussie's AAA rating is under threat because we're spending too much and their bludging on the public purse is making it more difficult for the government to fix up the deficit, the spending problem, by slashing taxes on the rich, which would make us all better off? All, note that all, including these selfish, selfish people who bludge on the NDIS and the public purse. Here we are, tossing and turning all night, unable to sleep over the prospect of losing our AAA rating, and these people don't even care. Oh, just a few useful clues if we ever do have the misfortune to meet one of these bludgers. Assume they are stupid. Take for granted they can't hear. Use the most simple language and yell. Always yell. And finally, it's not like they've been largely ignored. Why, we don't have to recall now, right here in 2016, when, okay, there may be a few barriers, a few biases, but the governments have promised to act. Why, they've promised that all public transport, for instance, will be 100% accessible within 15 years. Are they never satisfied? Good morning.
Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, celebrating International Day of People with Disability. And the last contribution that Solidarity Breakfast has got to offer for this wonderful day as we celebrate is a discussion I had, or a chat I had, with Kirsty Wilson. Now, Kirsty Wilson is the principal legal practitioner for AED Legal Centre. AED stands for Association of Employees with Disability. Now, Kirsty is the co-winner of this year's National Disability Award for the category Excellence in Justice and Rights Promotion. She's been working for a long time on wage justice for people with disability.
What we've been working since 2002 is in relation to wages for people working in Australian disability enterprises, or what was known as sheltered workshops, where they had been paid a dollar a day, 5 cents an hour, that sort of thing. What we said is that, you know, they should have the same rights to wages, to equitable wages, as anybody else in the workforce. And that if every other employee is, you know, there's a minimum wage, that these workers are also entitled to have their wages assessed at the minimum wage. So basically, you know, you start off, say, for example, $10 an hour. If that person is not 100% productive, or they might be 80% productive, they might get 80% of the wage, so $8 an hour. But you've got to have that starting point, and these workers didn't have that. So we've been fighting to get that right, and that it be a wage assessment tool that is that uses productivity only, not competencies which aren't relevant to these workers.
Can you explain that to me?
All right. What that means is, like, the tool that we actually took, and it went all the way through to the High Court, where it was confirmed that it was actually discriminatory, was divided into two parts. So there was the productivity element, and there was a competency element, and things like what meetings does your boss go to, or what do you do if the machinery is faulty. Well, these aren't relevant questions. I mean, I don't get asked most of us don't get asked what meetings does our boss go to, and if we don't know the answer, we lose a percentage of our wage. And that's what happened with this particular tool, is that so some employees might end up with zero for the competency, and say they were 50% productive, it would then be divided into half because they were zero for the competencies. So they'd end up with 25% of the wage. And we just said that's not, you know, that's discriminatory.
Yeah, it's extraordinary that it should be based on competence. That's called competency.
Yes, that's exactly right. And in some sections of that part is, you know, they might only work in the gardening section. So for the other three of the industry-specific competencies, they would get zero for those other three, but they don't work in that area. So again, you know, if I, you know, I being a lawyer, I only work in that area, but say that the assessment was that I needed to know what to do in, you know, in different, like working in a bar, I don't know what to do, I don't know how to pour drinks or mix drinks, so I'd lose a percentage of my wage because I don't know how to do that, or I don't work in that particular area, and that's what this tool meant.
So when you're talking about a tool, is this a computerised tool?
No, it's not. It's a design that how can you assess wages to, because they are considered that they shouldn't be paid the minimum wage. So what we say, there's a supported wage, and what happens with the supported wage, which is used in open employment, is that you have a comparator, and the comparator is the average worker. So, for example, you work at Coles, you're packing or packing the shelves, you've got the average worker, there's a benchmark that's worked out. So this is what, effectively, the average worker would do in half an hour. So the worker with the disability who isn't 100% productive will be measured or timed in accordance with that benchmark. And if they come up at 90% of what that benchmark is, then they will be paid 90% of the wage. But it is only on their productivity. It's only measured on how many stockings that they, you know, put the lollies in for Christmas, for example, or how long it takes them to do facing up at the supermarket in a certain area, and how much time it would take somebody, the average worker. So it's not the fastest worker, it's not the slowest worker. So that's a tool to assess how you can pay people.
Well, it's a very interesting approach, isn't it, to see a person in this light. But, of course, you're going to the court, so you have to work it out in a very rigid, rational sort of a way. And you're talking about sheltered workshops, so I suppose that's what, I don't know if that's the term that's still
employment.
Used. Supported
it's,
employment.
Look, it's not, but a lot of people know them by that name rather than they were when the tool was designed. It was business, they were business services. Now they're Australian Disability Enterprises or ADEs. So they, you know, they sort of changed the name, but they're supported employment. So they're effectively set up. They have funding from the government to provide that support, but the wages are paid out of the contracts. So if they are contracted to do the mowing or car wash, for example, or washing windows, that's the job that they do. And they, you know, the business has to make the, you know, put the tenders out for whatever business they do. It could be sugar sticks in boxes, muesli bars. You know, there's a whole range of things that are done, and the majority of the work is production-like work.
Okay, and so are we talking about people with intellectual disabilities or physical disabilities?
Look, about 85% approximately, and that number is, you know, sometimes it's more, sometimes it's less, but approximately 85% of the workers, and there's around 20,500 or 21,000 of employees, supported employees around Australia. So probably around 85% of the workers have an intellectual disability.
And so the idea behind these services are to give people self-sufficiency?
Well, the idea is to give them supported, you know, to give them employment, but to provide support where they're needed, where it's needed. And that might mean, you know, reminding them to stay on task, or reminding them to, you know, not to talk so much, you know, in regards, I don't mean that in a patronising way, but like in regards, you know, you're here to work, so therefore you need to be working. Or it could be that they need to be continually shown how to do something, or it might take longer to train them in different tasks, work tasks, this is.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, what's the purpose of it ultimately for the person who is disabled? That's what I'm thinking.
All right, well, the purpose is employment.
Yeah, so that they actually have
employment.
And they actually have wages.
Well, that's right, and the wages should be wages that mean that it will help them in regards to having a quality of life, their living standards. So if you're going to pay them a dollar a day, you're not going to contribute to their living standards.
That's right. So the organisations that are involved in this, are they private organisations?
Well, they are private as such, but they're funded by the government. I mean, you can't just go and open an ADE. There are a certain number of places and you have to, have those places. So, but they're run by, Wesley, Scope. A very large one is Endeavour Foundation. They have ADEs in Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. So, or they could be run by the... Usually church groups or...
They see themselves as doing good works. That's what I'm getting at. They see themselves as being social welfare organisations.
Yes, right across the board. So I'm not saying that this employment is social welfare because it is employment. They are going to work. They're doing a job and they're doing a necessary job. Whichever way you look at it, the work that they do is important.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's just interesting because, remember, a couple of years ago, Vision Australia decided it was going to, didn't see it as being a core part of their operations to keep providing employment to members.
Well, yeah, and look, I guess the thing is that they have to compete for the contracts. And as more and more contracts sort of go overseas, it does make it more difficult for there to be the work. But, there are ADEs out there that, one that I know of, they're stationed outside the local TIP, and this is a rural town. So the ADE is set up outside the TIP. Before any person goes to the TIP, they have to stop at the ADE. They go through it and take out anything that they can be used. And it could be old books, it could be wood, different posts or cut-offs of wood. It could be white goods. And so before they can go to the TIP, everything is taken out that can be used. And they have a huge I don't know whether it's a warehouse or however you look at it, but you can go there and you can buy furniture, you can buy wood for, you're making something out in the garden. They're just a huge range. They also have a section which probably isn't an ADE, but it joins on to the ADE where they repair the white goods. And so people who, who want to buy things at a, reduced price can go out there, and it's a bit like one of, the, they used to call them op shops. I don't know what they call them now, but
it's a local initiative.
Yeah, and it's fantastic.
Well, what I was wondering about this, with this work that you've been doing over such a long time, are you struggling with general societal perceptions? Is that an issue?
Yes, yeah, it is an issue. People think that we're trying to close ADEs down, that we don't, that we're not looking at the bigger picture, but I would disagree. I think that, to me, it is really important that every employee or every person in Australia, adult person, has a right to earn an equitable wage, has a right to be able to go to work. And, the argument that it's more than work, it's social, it's their social life, they've got their friends there, they're safe. I agree that is part of it, but we all have friends at work. We all have, it is, everyone who goes to work, it is very much part of our life. And why should a person with disability not have that same right to do that? But we do, yes, as I said, we do have a lot of people think that we're trying to force ADEs to close down. That's just not true at all. I know that there's arguments that if they have to pay productivity wages, they won't be able to be viable. And to me, it's two separate arguments. you need to have an equitable tool. You need to be able to assess wages with a tool that is going to be non-discriminatory. The viability of the ADE is another matter. That's the business. The business itself needs to be viable. Why should a worker miss out on being paid because the argument is that they're not going to be viable? And the other thing is we don't know. We won't know until a new tool is set up and is rolled out whether an ADE or, you know, particular business is going to be viable. We haven't seen any figures in regards to that or any evidence to suggest it. We know that there's a number of ADEs who use the supported wage, which is the tool, as I said before, that we believe should be used. And, you know, so they're already using it. But these tools that, you know, the business services wage assessment tools or BSWAT and a number of other tools, there's 27 other tools in the award, which have all got competencies, and we're saying that they are all discriminatory and that they should be removed. Two more of these tools are in the federal court at the moment. That's Green Acres and Skills Master, and our argument is the same, that they are discriminatory and they should be removed. I know if it was my child, I would be fighting tooth and nail for her rights to be recognised. I know that every one of my clients who come to me and say, I want to be paid a decent wage, I want to be able to go to work, yes, but I want to be able to have the things that I can't afford because being on the DSP does not pay for me to have a steak occasionally or to go on a holiday or to go down to Tasmania because my football team is Hawthorn and I want to be able to go and support them. Like so many people who don't have a disability, who work in open employment, they have those, are able to go and do that. And my clients want the same rights.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast, celebrating Disability Day, and we're listening to a chat with Kirsten Wilson from the AED Legal Centre about wage justice. This is a whole issue of about charity, isn't it? This idea that we're doing you a favour. And then you talk about the notion that the worker is taking a lower wage because otherwise the business wouldn't function. So actually it's a two-way street that this charity, this misplaced charity, is expected to play out.
Yes, that's right. And the argument that, oh, it's much harder to work with it or to deal with a group of people with disabilities. So, you know, you can understand that it's okay to pay them that lower wage. Well, I don't agree with that either. It's not a charity. They are going to work. They are, you know, packing Christmas stockings or Easter eggs into, you know, with toys or muesli bars or, you know, a whole range of things. They do the tea, you know, T2 is one of the contracts I've seen. Gardening, washing windows, car washing, cleaning, you know, office cleaning. There's a whole range of things that they do. And as I said before, these are real jobs. And the business is being paid for the contract.
Yes, well, they're not just being paid these challenges, legal challenges. Are they related, like most cases, to individuals who have come to you, to your centre, or are you...
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can't take action unless we're instructed. You know, being a solicitor, I have to, you know, the client will come and will instruct me to act for them, and they will say, look, and like with Green Acres and with Skills Master, both of those particular clients work at, you know, the different ADEs and have come and said, the wages I get, I don't agree that this is a fair assessment on my wage.
So it takes a certain amount of bravery on the part of the litigant.
Oh, definitely, definitely. And it's not easy. You know, like Liz Nogin, who took the action on behalf of Michael initially, you know, she started it all off back in 2003, 2004. She's an incredible woman. You know, the strength that she has, and she, her view was that I've got two sons, one with disability, one without disability, and Michael is just as entitled as his brother to have an equitable wage and to have opportunities in the future. You know, I'm not going to be here forever, and I want him to be able to earn enough money to be able to have a decent, a quality way of life.
Well, that's fascinating.
And Gordon Pryor, who also was, so there were two applicants there. He came a little bit later, but they were joined in the end. And he was the same. He said, I want to be paid a wage that I don't think that this is right. And he's interesting because he left the ADE and went to work at a laundromat and jumped from, I think he was on $3 something. Yeah, it was around that amount, up to $15 an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
Under the supported wage. So, you know, huge jump. And his hours while, you know, working at the laundromat increased. So he was working longer hours and he was earning a lot more money. And it gave him, you know, a quality of life. He was able to buy things, do things that he wanted to do. But he also, because, you know, you're allowed to earn around $85 a week before it starts impacting on the pension. And this isn't just for people with disabilities. It's for people on Newstart. It's for people, you know, for whatever different pension that they're on. They are allowed to earn a certain amount before they start losing money from the pension. So he was much better off earning a decent wage.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Would have changed his entire life.
That's exactly right, yeah.
I was really intrigued to know that your legal centre existed. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Well, when I first started working in this area, it was in 2002, it was for a bigger organisation and we were just one section of that organisation. And, you know, the government decided that it was a conflict of interest to, because we were adversarial, because obviously legal is adversarial, is seen as being adversarial, and the others were service providers, but also the employment area, for example, they were finding people jobs. But if there were issues with those jobs, they might come to us to ask for representation. So there's that conflict is, you know, we're trying to maintain you in this job, but we've got the advocacy section who is challenging the way that you're being treated, for example. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah, and so, anyway, the government stopped funding.
Which government?
That organisation. Federal government. So we're funded under the National Disability Advocacy Program, so NDAP program.
Okay.
And they wanted obviously the service to continue. So we were set up as a separate association and applied for the funding and got it. So effectively the team from that organisation moved across to AED and we established AED Legal Centre through the Association of Employees with Disability. So that was in 2008. And since then we have grown our numbers. So when I started in 2002, we had 9 clients. So we now have around 350.
The clients, what are the range of clients?
Well, we have those who we're working on in relation to BSWOT and the other wage tools, but we also have, we've got a hearing at the moment at VCAT, and that's in relation to an employee who was disciplined and the impact on with her disability, that she was treated differently and basically shouldn't have been disciplined, but anyway
that's another issue.
And that's another issue, but so there's a discrimination in the way that she's been treated. We've got another one later this week who an unlawful termination. So we do jobs at risk. We have a number of educational matters where children are not there because of their disabilities. They need accommodations at school, and it could be that those accommodations are not being given. So we only do employment and education, and it has to link to the disability. So if somebody comes and they've got a disability but it doesn't link to the issue, then we're not going to be able to assist them.
Now, are you at all connected to the system for community legal centres? Are they? Is that at all?
We are. We're a member of the community legal, so the federation and also the national, the NACL one.
Yeah.
But we don't. We're not funded under
the same
program as what they are.
Yeah.
They're,
right.
Funded under the Attorney General's program, so yeah. we don't get the same sort of funding. Our funding is a lot less than.
Oh,
than
right.
that.
Okay.
So it's a real struggle financially, because obviously doing legal work is very costly, and the clients don't pay for our services.
Yes, right. That makes sense.
Or, you know, the work we do, and we barristers, like today with the hearing that we've got, it's a 2-day hearing, and we've got a barrister who has come through Justice Connect, and he is doing it pro bono. Which is so generous when you consider how much time, you know, in preparing a hearing. I mean, you know, it's a huge for us as well. But they to give their time without being paid is incredible.
Yeah, it's good. Now, the other thing is it only in Victoria or is it in other states as well?
The work we do.
Yeah, well, the work, only, yes, I'm sure.
There is only, AED is the only one in Australia.
Wow.
Which is such a shame. It really should be all over Australia.
Yeah.
There's such a demand for the work. And the thing is, we don't advertise. We couldn't advertise. If we did, we wouldn't be able to keep up with the workload. We struggle as it is. We have a number of students. So we work with Deakin University, their law school, and we have up to 9 or 10 students each trimester who come one day a week. So they do 15 weeks, and without them and without our other students and volunteers, we just wouldn't be able to function. We fundraise. I mean, I was at a Trash and Treasure yesterday, you know, fundraising for AED. We do film nights, sell chocolates, you name it. We do anything we can to try and earn, you know, to get extra money in for AED, because it's a, you know, struggle with the funding we get, but our clients need that support. You know, there's filing fees that many of them, you know, they lose their job. They haven't got the money to file, to pay the filing fees. So we try and fundraise to pay for those sort of things.
It's interesting too, because every piece of legal work and success you have, you change history, don't you?
Well, that's right. I mean, it might be just for the individual, but then like with BSWAT, the impact that you know, over 20,000 workers will get better wages from the work, and the government introduced legislation that is going to back pay people who were assessed under BSWAT, so they will get the money that was owed to them because they were assessed under a discriminatory tool. Yeah, it has changed the lives of many of our clients, and it's, you know, it's not an area that there's huge amounts of money paid. That's just not the jurisdiction we work in. But to see the difference that it makes to the clients, how, you know, that they've stood up for themselves, the sense of empowerment and their self-esteem, those are what are really important, and that's what we fight for. We fight to give them the same rights as everybody else, but we fight to give them a voice.
Thanks very much, Kirsty, for talking to me.
Oh, that's a pleasure. Thank you for that. Listening.
Well, that's it for Solidarity Breakfast this morning on 3CR. I hope you have enjoyed our look back at some milestones in the political struggle for rights by people with disabilities. We followed that up with a look at disability sports and recreation, and then the fight for wage justice for workers with disability. Enjoy the rest of 3CR's tribute to people with disability on this International Day of People with Disability 2016.
That was my turn. Let's double the intro.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia, on the Kulin Nation. For more information and to find out how you can support 3CR, go to www.3cr.org.au.